All right. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Tax Committee. We're officially starting right on time at 10:15. Fair enough, tradition of Chair David's. He is detained at this moment. But when we have a quorum, we'll pause to officially gavel us in. Before we introduce House File 3688 by Representative Tim O'Driscoll, I'd like to give a warm welcome, and please all join me in welcoming a happy birthday to Chair Carlson.
Well, thank you very much. And the cookies were from my legislative assistant, Lil Polkan. So,
excellent. Well, thank you for the cookies.
Have a cookie or two. It looks like there's enough there for...
Yes. Representative Driscoll, can you please pass out the cookies, and then we'll hear your bill.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair? If you get early enough, you can probably take three.
Yes. Representative Lesch.
And I also wanted to congratulate Representative Carlson. I think this year marks a year that is the first year that he's served in the legislature more years than he's been alive.
That's an interesting challenge.
I thought it was true.
Thank you, Representative Lesch. You might need to... Were you a math teacher, Representative Carlson? Representative Lesch might need a little math history.
Legislative math history.
Okay.
You know, I was a social studies teacher, but, you know, you look at charts and graphs and so on, and the common question of the students have thought this was a history class. They would confuse it. It was a government economics. Thought this was a history class. Why are we doing math, you know, when you're doing population trends or whatever you are?
Certainly. From the eyes of, from the mouths of children. So with that, I'll move House File 3688 to be reconsidered for possible in... Oh, he's lucky. Today's your lucky day, Mr. O'Driscoll. This will be this will be sent to the General Register. So with that in mind, Representative O'Driscoll, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. A little bit of background on House File 3688. In 2010, the Minnesota Legislature approved what is called PACE financing, and PACE is an acronym that stands for Property Assessed Clean Energy. This bill does not do anything to change the options of clean energy. What it does is it clarifies how the financing would take place on that, on those. And, Mr. Chair, as the committee is getting settled in your packet for House File 3688 is a handout that I'd like to have the members pull, and I want to use that to explain what's under current law and what we would end up changing should this become law, and provide consumers in the state of Minnesota some additional protections that aren't currently afforded to them under Minnesota law.
And Representative O'Driscoll, is this item correct right here?
That is right, Workflow? Mr. Chair. Yep. It says across the top, residential PACE in capital letters, loan position. And if you could also have a pencil handy, because I've got a little bit of, in keeping with your comments earlier, Mr. Chair, a little homework assignment for us as we go through on this. On the left-hand side of the page under current law, the first priority lien under Minnesota statute is a property tax lien. And that would also include any special assessment liens on property that might be for such things as roads, sidewalks, sewer water assessments. And then a first mortgage where someone might have purchased a home, and you'll note in that second box it says April 22nd, 2011. That's the day that the lender recorded the mortgage that they used to finance that property. And then in the third box, it talks about August 22nd, 2015. There was another lien. Perhaps it's a home equity loan or a second mortgage or a mechanics lien or some other type of lien. Then let's assume the homeowner wanted to do some PACE financing on their property using the property assessed clean energy. Well, what happened would be that particular item, although it's number four on the list and number four on the timeline, if you draw an arrow from that box and put it right between boxes number one and number two, under current law, that's where that lien would end up going. So let's talk about what's covered by that lien. A city, a community would have the ability to go out and to sell bonds and assess property for home improvements that would be for clean energy. I feel that this can be somewhat problematic for residents, particularly in established neighborhoods where equity might be limited in those homes, or they may be first-time home buyers, not having a lot of money as a down payment and wanting to do improvements to that home. So what could end up happening is an individual could buy a home, let's say, for $100,000, put a $5,000 down payment, have $95,000 in equity, A contractor could come by and say, have I got a deal for you? You don't even have to go to the bank to borrow money. We'll just add these improvements to your property taxes, and when the property tax statement comes, you'll simply pay for them then. And that is, I think, a little bit predatory for individuals when they're looking at that. And what could end up happening is maybe $15,000 worth of improvements that are done on that house. House is only worth $100,000, and we've got the property with more liens on it than is worth than what the value of the property is. And what that does is that puts that first mortgage in a very difficult position, because in order for them to preserve the lien that they helped to finance that home, they were in the position ahead of, as far as work is concerned, than the PACE financing was. They are going to end up being subordinated, and they would end up having to buy out and pay off that lien on the home in order to preserve their position on the property. My fear is that if we don't do what I'll show you in number two, that we're going to have a higher rate of default and potential foreclosure on properties in the state of Minnesota just at the time that we don't need another housing crisis. Referring to the second column, everything is exactly the same except number four, where it was financed on March 15th, 2018. It would stay in that position, and they would not gain priority over any other liens on the property. I would like to share a comment as I wrap up, Mr. Chair, with the setup of the bill from what Representative Hertaus said earlier this week in property tax. I think he explained it best when he said property assessments on property are for public improvements. This is clearly a private improvement, and so it should be treated as a loan and be treated like any other lien on property and not given a preferential treatment. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I do have two amendments that will help us get the bill in the form that we'd like if you do have a quorum at this time.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Members, is there any questions at this time? Very good. I do have a question, Representative O'Driscoll. How many instances, perhaps in 2017 or even now in the 4 months of 2018, have we experienced with this particular issue happening?
Mr. Chair, very good question. Last year we put a moratorium on this. It had not been used, but there was a company that was coming in from California that wanted to start utilizing this, and they basically wanted Minnesota to adopt their business model. And we put a halt on it and said we wanted to have a chance to study this closer in Minnesota and before we pull the trigger and allow a PACE on residential. It's been in place on commercial property, which I would put them in a completely different category than a homeowner on this. And so if we don't adopt this, we could have predatory circumstances or situations that could present themselves in Minnesota. And my understanding as well, Mr. Chair, to that same question, is the group that was coming from California that was advocating that we adopt a business model similar to public policy similar to their business model has since pulled up stakes and decided they don't want to because they see that this bill is getting a lot of traction and legislative support in both the House and the Senate.
Well, well done, Representative O'Driscoll. We have another question from a member, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative O'Driscoll. So am I understanding that this bill really entails PACE loans being able to be added to the assessment? Are there other loans that can also qualify to be added to your assessment other than just PACE loans?
Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg,
I'm going to
answer that as there could be. In my work in local government, I can't think of anything that we would have had. There might be some other special assessing authority that a local unit of government might have or subdivision of government would have the ability to do that in certain circumstances or situations. But those would, again, go back to, as Representative Hertaus put it, those would be public improvements. Those would not be private financing of financing the private homes of amenities.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, what I'm thinking of is sometimes when you have a street improvement in front of your house, when they're coming by, sometimes they'll say, hey, we'll redo your driveway. And then I was just wondering if that might be something that could be added to assessment as well and whether or not that would be qualified underneath this particular bill also.
Representative O'Driscoll?
Representative Petersburg, I know of what you're talking about because in my work in local government, we have done that in our established neighborhoods where it's time to do some of that infrastructure improvement. And usually what we do is we would have had them pay that at a reduced rate because the contractors and they're doing all of that work, and we wouldn't normally roll that in. And part of that is bond council, when you sell those bonds, may say that that's private improvement versus public improvement that's being done with the street, road, curb, sewer, water, sidewalk, those kind of amenities. Again, I'm not a lien specialist in the state of Minnesota on this, but that's just relying back on my local government experience. And the chair also has some local government experience on that as well, and he may have some thoughts on it too. I'm not sure.
Very good. Representative O'Driscoll, members, we have a quorum, so officially call this meeting to order. I'd like to also move the...
Mr. Chairman, I think a quorum would be 13. Do you have some that checked in?
Let's see. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Detmer. Yes.
You got somebody that checked in.
We do. Yep. Very good. Thank you, Chair Carlson. So that will, again, officially call the meeting to order, and would you will also officially move the bill, House File 3688, for be put on the general register. And is there any amendments as well, Representative?
Mr. Chair, I do have two amendments, and they're both author amendments. And the first amendment, if someone would move the A4 amendment, and with the A4 amendment, I can once it's moved, I can explain it if you'd like. However you want to do it, Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the A4 amendment. I have heard this bill in property tax, so this is a good change that's going to be made. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Erickson. Representative O'Driscoll, would you explain your amendment?
Mr. Chair, what this does is in working with the Senate as they're moving the bill along and working with the Department of Revenue, there were some wordsmithing or word changes that need to be done to help clarify statute. And there is a representative from the Department of Revenue here who could speak to this matter if you'd like. It's purely technical in nature.
Very good. Unless a member wants to hear that technical in nature explanation, we'll just move forward. You have another amendment, Representative
Rubis? Do you want to vote on that amendment, Mr. Chair?
Yes, we have to vote for adoption. Thank you, Mr. Rubis. All in favor of accepting the A4 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carries.
And, Mr. Chair, I also have another amendment.
Representative O'Driscoll?
It's the A18 amendment, if someone could move that for me.
Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair, I move the A18-0780.
Mm-hmm. Very good. All in favor of moving the A780 amendment, whatever it was? A818 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Would you explain your amendment, and then
Chair,
Representative Hurt has a question.
What this does is this is working with MLTA, the Minnesota Association that deals with title insurance and title work in the state of Minnesota. They had a comfort level that said that when these case loans are done, that they need to be recorded. So if you refer back to the graph, that when this came in, it would be recorded, so it would show up on the public in public record on the title, so that when the individual went to sell, they would know that as a purchaser that there was a loan on that property. Because there could be some lag time from the time that the work was done till an individual sells, and we just want to make sure that that gets recorded. I don't know if you necessarily have to have it in there. My assumption would be that people would, as a mortgage company, record. That's how you protect yourself. But this is just a belt and suspenders approach to make sure that the property that would have this would have it a public record.
Very good. Always good to have
Mr. Chair, that is all I have for the committee.
Very good. Representative Hertos, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question comment was to the bill and not the amendment. Or are we at that point?
We are on the bill, Representative Hertos.
Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll, I just wanted to thank you for bringing this forward and having heard it in property tax. We clearly understand the need to protect the priority of first mortgages, and appreciate you doing it. I was just wondering if you could tell me how this came to your attention in the first place, because it certainly had slipped my radar as a member of the real estate community. I just never had picked up on it until you start talking about it.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hertos, before I answer your question, I paid you a compliment, and I thought you, at the end of property tax, summarized the mission and purpose of this bill, that a property assessment is for a public good. This is a private investment, and so it should be treated as a loan. So I wanted to, again, what you were in the room, pay you that compliment. Second, how this came to my attention, It came to me honestly because of my involvement in Minnesota's regulated industries, appraisal, real estate, insurance, securities, and the like. And this place, when folks get to know your background and stuff, they see a problem, they tend to find legislators who have some insight and understanding on those topics. And so about a year and a half ago, that's how it came to me.
Representative Hertos?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative O'Driscoll. Yeah, thanks for that explanation. And most of the customers I work with would not be using these types of things, so it's an instrument I just never really caught my radar. But thanks for addressing this, because property rights and making sure that the access to credit and mortgage availability in our state should be central to the issue here. And if we start doing things that jeopardize the security of a mortgage, then we see opportunity and credit or access to credit start to diminish and leave Minnesota. So thanks for bringing this forward.
Very good, Representative Hertos. Any other questions from members? Oh, Representative Lesch, I didn't mean to ignore you. Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative O'Driscoll, can you tell me who's this company that wanted to come in and try this model? What's their name?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesch, the name of the company was Renovate America, and they had come on the scene about a year and a half ago wanting to start doing this, and they had asked that we adopt their business model, which would have been opposite of what I'm proposing today, which would be that property tax lien could take priority over all other liens and be considered a priority lien in Minnesota. And they had advocated saying that, well, you know, we've never had a default on these types of things in any other states that we have done. And I think I explained earlier, and I'll just refer back to my testimony, that why they have not had a default is that First Mortgage Company went in and bought out that special assessment to preserve their investment in that property as the lender. And to what Representative Hertos said, if we have a situation where lenders see that being able to happen, that could be a skittish issue of being able to make loans, and that could affect interest rates and availability and access to credit when people need it most.
Representative Lesch?
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and Representative O'Driscoll. It is a concern of mine, first of all. Are there other folks who are going to testify on this? Do we have any bankers or other folks that are going to come in and further explain their perspective on the situation?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Representative Lesch, I have a host of people that are here, and I can just give you a little bit of background. The group that's working on the task force was everyone from the lenders to the real estate folks to the title folks that I mentioned earlier have been involved. We also have had legal aid involved in this. We've had county groups involved in this. We've had city groups involved in this. This came about as a task force that we put together last summer as a part of legislation to investigate and find what would be right for Minnesota on this. We certainly can have them come down and testify, but they are all in agreement on the bill and the position.
Okay.
It's to the members and the chair's discretion if they're here, if you want to hear from them. But they felt comfortable with me presenting the bill with my background on the bill and my industry experience. I'm happy to do whatever the committee and chair want to do.
No, well, Mr. Chair, Representative Driscoll, no, it's not that I don't trust you or anything, and I don't necessarily need to hear from you from them, but I just am curious about it, considering many members on this committee sat here during the subprime crash in 08, and you know, sometimes we look at these situations as, you know, whether it's going to be good for banks or not. Well, folks in Minnesota know that during that subprime crash, many local banks felt pressured into, shall we say, more permissive practices based upon the market competition they were facing, both in the state and out of the state. So, that would be a rather in-depth conversation, but, you know, I guess I am interested in the situation, so I appreciate you bringing it forward.
Very good. Members, any other questions? Representative O'Driscoll, closing statements?
Mr. Chair, this bill has had a long journey from last year, and this year I think this is our sixth or seventh committee stop. It's certainly been vetted well today, and I appreciate members' support. So I'd ask that House File 3688 as amended be referred to the General Register, sir.
Very good. That is Representative Erickson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that will be my motion.
Very good. All in favor of House File 3688 to be referred to as amended to be referred to the General Register, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Thank you,
Representative. Mr. Chair, members.
100% Mark.
Welcome to the committee, and I guess birthday wishes are in order. Chair Carlson?
Well, Mr. Chairman, you're late in arriving, but it was acknowledged by our vice chair, but if you want to do it again, that would be great. But it gives me an opportunity to remind folks, being that we were rather lightly attended at the beginning, Lil Polkamp, my legislative assistant, in honor of my birthday today, provided cookies, and they're at the front of the room. So we can either pass them around or whatever the chair prefers.
Mr. Chair, they're delicious. I think they should be passed around.
I would concur with that.
Yes.
And by the way, Mr. Chairman, I'll yield to my having to go first because I've already had a cookie.
Oh, just time out. President Barr, do you have an announcement? Is it your birthday?
I do have an announcement. It is not my birthday, but, and I didn't know it was yours, so happy birthday, but because this is my first time up in committee, I would not have come without bringing treats. So I, too, have brought some treats. You guys will not go hungry today.
All in favor, say aye. Oh, so why don't you start passing stuff around? Yeah, that'd be great. So happy birthday, Chair Carlson.
Well, thank you.
Awesome. Awesome. I'll officially call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. We have a quorum?
Yep.
We've had a quorum. Wow. Boy, McDonald knows
how long.
Oh, the minutes. Representative Schultz moves the minutes of Tuesday, April 17th, 2018. Any additions or corrections?
Oh, yeah.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, members. Okay, item next, we'll go to, I will move House File 4367. And seeing no amendments, we will turn the bill over to you. So I'll move the bill. Two-year bill, Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a pretty straightforward bill. House File 4367 provides an upfront sales tax exemption for the construction of a new fire station in my city, Invergrove Heights. And with me to testify today on behalf of the bill is Invergrove Heights Mayor George Torville and our Fire Chief Judy Thill. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I would either answer questions or be happy to let my testifiers go.
Why don't we get into testimony here? Let's who starts? Well, I'm a former mayor, so of course we start with the mayor. Mayor Torville, Your Honor, please proceed.
Chairman and anybody else that has a birthday, too, you got cookies today, so it's great. Thank you for hearing us on the House File 4367. And, again, it's for a new fire station in the city of Invergrove Heights. The fire chief is going to do a quick update, but we're looking for the exemption on sales tax for the construction materials and supplies. We are looking. There is no uniform bill that is out there, so we've been told each individual city that has a request to come forward to the tax committee. So we appreciate being able to be here today. We thank Representative Barr for signing off on this and getting us started. So I'll turn it over to the fire chief, and we'll stand for questions when we're done.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Please state your name and who represents for the record, please.
Judy Thill, Fire Chief of the City of Invergrove Heights.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and everybody. Thank you for this opportunity to speak this morning. Just a little bit of a background on our community and our fire station. Our city is 32 square miles with a population of 38,000. Presently, we have two fire stations serving our residents and businesses. Both fire stations are located in the upper one-third of the city. As a result, response times to the properties at the southern part of the city can take 15 minutes or even longer. As you can imagine, during serious medical calls, fires, crashes, and other emergencies, minutes count. We have mutual aid agreements with neighboring fire departments. However, their stations are not any closer than ours. In 2010, the city hired a third party to conduct a study which confirmed the need for a station further south in our city. The study also included recommendations for a general location of where the new station should be built. One of our current stations was built in the 1970s and had space added to it later in the 70s. The other station was rebuilt in the 1980s. The number of calls have increased dramatically over the years. In the 70s, we responded to approximately 200 calls per year out of those two fire stations with our 60 volunteer paid-on-call firefighters. In 2017, With those two fire stations and 60 volunteer paid on-call firefighters, we responded to 1,600 calls. More total calls mean more calls to the southern part of the city and even more calls with longer response times. The station we're looking to build will be 30,000 square feet, which includes a partial basement. A large portion of that basement, as well as other features designed in the fire station, would be for firefighter training. At the moment, we have to send firefighters out of our city to do much of the training because we do not have those capabilities elsewhere in our city. We also hope to build into this new station equipment and space for decontaminating fire gear. Studies have shown that 63% of all firefighters are expected to get cancer, compared to 41% of the general population. This includes both volunteer and career firefighters. Because cardiac issues are the biggest killer of firefighters nationwide, we'd also like to add a workout room available for firefighters to use. The cost of the construction of the building is expected to be $6,700,000, and the cost of utilities, water, and sewer is expected to be $1,015,000. At this time, I will answer any questions. Thank you.
Questions for members? Chair Drazkowski? I'm sorry. You.
Mr. Chair, it was perfectly timed.
It was. I wanted you to talk a little longer. Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just, maybe this is a question for Ms. Dalton or Mr. Michael. If we adopt this as written, will this exemption appear in perpetuity, or is it a one-time thing for a one-time event? What does that look like with the bill?
Ms. Dalton, to the Drazkowski question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if you look on line 12, this essentially expires January 1, 2021.
Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Ms. Dalton. I read all the way through line 10, and then I ended. Thank you.
Okay, other questions for members? Vice Chair McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. After thoroughly reading the bill past line 10, question for the fire chief. In your city, is the city offering permits and sack and whack fees and some other exemptions as well to the building of your firm?
Chief Till, or Your Honor?
I'll take that. The new fire station is not in the MUSA district, so we will be paying sack and whack, and we do have to go across Highway 52, and that's the reason for the additional cost of the utilities. The reason why we're asking for the tax exemption is that we're then going to be able to put some more effort into some of the training and also some of the safety equipment. And I'll mention one thing, and Judy mentioned on the part of the cancer and heart attack, is that I am a retired firefighter, but I served in the Inver Grove Heights Fire Department for 26 years. And this study started probably even before the 3 years, and taking a look at how we could serve the next 15 or 20 years in the city of Inver Grove Heights. So we took a look at a lot of different areas, but this is the site that worked out the best. The city can do some help on the sack and whack, but the construction costs of the pipe and that we can't exempt because that will be done by a third party.
Sure.
But it's a great question. Yeah.
Vice Chair McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for members? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on behalf of the bill with concerns? Does the department wish to testify? Duly noted. Okay, so let's go to Representative Metza and then Carlson. Representative Metza.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and our community. I know I've said this in a previous testimony for Chair Loon's bill. Our community is in a very similar position. We had a highway relocation. Our fire hall is actually about 50 years older than the two we've discussed down here in the committee, and I haven't prepared a bill yet, but I do think this is something we could do to help out communities to make sure that they have a little bit of help from the state to make sure that we're keeping things good for service response times. We've got a training need as well, and our community is actually looking at purchasing some homes and acquiring land that currently is residential and rezoning, making sure that it can become a public safety center. So I just look forward to continuing to work with you and to include the community of Virginia in that so that we could have a really good omnibus bill, Mr. Chair.
Oh, it'll be good. Thank you, Representative Metza. Let's go to Chair Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I was just curious, the testimony earlier, it sounded like your current fire stations are located in a fairly great distance, if you will, from part of your city. And I wanted to ask, do you have any barriers then that would interfere with public safety vehicles, fire, or ambulance from getting from one part of the city to the other? The reason I asked that question, we had a big issue in the Crystal, New Hope, Robbinsdale area where BNSF and Canadian Pacific wanted to reroute some trains, and that would have cut off, you know, how those trains are sometimes a mile long if you had an emergency, large parts of those communities. And I'm just curious if this helps resolve that issue. It sounded like it did. If you've got barriers, or maybe your barrier is just simply distance. But
Your Honor, or Chief Dill?
Chief, handle that one.
Presently, we do not have any. We do have some barriers, but we have some workarounds. It does take a little bit more time. This one, there probably are some tracks that we would have to cover. That would, where it's going to actually help us is we're going to be that much closer. So if we have to wait a couple minutes for a train, then that couple minutes won't be added on to an already 15-minute response time. But we've actually don't have any barriers like the Crystal New Hope does where we're really going to be stopped. We have a couple different ways to come in from our target different location.
Chair Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, you sound like you were familiar with our situation, but, yeah, you were. I'm sure working with our county we were able to resolve it, but it did create quite a major issue in terms of public safety and timing to get to people in the emergency situation was the fear if the tracks had been changed to allow long trains to go through the city in a way that would have divided the city. And, you know, sometimes how long those trains take, you know, if they're going slowly through a city and if you had an emergency. But thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Chair Carlson. Vice Chair McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question is for Ms. Dalton. We see a lot of these bills over the years. I just texted our city administrator in Delano and asked if we did the same thing when we built ours in 2001-2, and we didn't. That's a shame. But nothing really is new around here. I'm wondering, has there been legislation that offered tax sales tax exemption on building supplies and materials for all fire departments? And second part of the question, how many of these are enacted into law over the last several years?
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there is actually one general one in law for courthouses, and that was enacted in a year when we had about five or six different counties come forward looking for courthouses and jails. And so we did actually do a general one for them. Anything else has been project-specific. I don't have the number right off the top of my head, but we've done a couple of them.
Vice Chairman.
There have been bills offered There have been bills that have been offered to just grant a carte blanche exemption for construction for all local government buildings. Those have not gone very far.
Vice Chair McDonald.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Dalton. Curious. Yeah, it seems like it would be probably a prudent thing to do since we do see a lot of these. But that's for another day. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions for members? And I think the department's out visiting with Mr. Michaels, so they could always come back and talk about this if they would like to. So with that, any other questions for members? Representative Barr, if you'd like to wrap it up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have nothing to add except that I appreciate your consideration of this bill.
Thank you, Representative Barr, and thank you to the fire chief and the mayor. With that, I will move that House File 4367 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Item next.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay. 1495, members, is Representative Miller. He is here. Okay, Representative Miller has House File 1495. There is a DE amendment that is going to be handed out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let's go, Representative Miller. I will move House File 1495. Please describe the bill as if it has been amended.
Thank you.
Your amendment, right?
That is, and Mr. Chair and members, the DE amendment really cleans it up, so it's probably best. So I appreciate your willingness to do that.
Okay.
The facts of the case, the tenets of what we're doing will remain the same, but the details that the Tax Committee would be most concerned about is in the DE. So I'll just move forward with what we're looking at. Some testifiers don't. We'll go from there.
Thank you very much, sir. Please proceed.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I thank you for your busy time here. I know a lot of things are going on right now with a lot of committees, and I appreciate this time. So in greater Minnesota, we have some wonderful industries, whether it be ethanol, or in my district we have Southern Minnesota Beet Sugar Cooperative. We also have dairy processing. We have industries that use a lot of electricity, and that's pretty much the nature of what they do. They also happen to produce a lot of heat. Now, that's what we're going to be trying to marry together with this. In the last presidential administration and in our current governor, our executive or governor administration, there's been a real push away from coal electricity. And we can have a debate on that any time, but the reality is this puts these industries in a very difficult position to find cheap, reliable energy. And so one of the things that they've been able to produce is technology called CHP, which basically allows them to capture the heat that they naturally produce in their industry and convert it into electricity. This is very pricey equipment to install, and I come very carefully and say when I say I want to provide tax credits for people that want to install something, because I believe that industry should fundamentally take care of themselves and make their decisions independently. But unfortunately, government has gotten in the way, and when it gets in the way, it makes them make decisions they rather wouldn't. And this is expensive technology that they would not be able to do if they can't find ways to make it more affordable. So what we're presenting to all of you today is a tax credit to be able to bring that cost down. So with that, I am going to, unless you want to continue on with something else, Mr. Chairman, let my testifiers go and do their talking.
Okay, let's do this first, though, Representative Miller, if we could here. We've moved 1495. I'll move the H1495DE1 amendment. That's the author's amendment. Any discussion? Hearing all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have the bill before us as amended. And before we go to the testifiers, is there anyone in the audience who's testifying on behalf of the bill with concerns thereof? I think the department would like to testify on this bill, so we'll have them when they get here. So please proceed. State your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Good morning, members of the committee, Mr. Chair. My name is Tim Rudnicki. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Biofuels Association.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. The association is based in Minneapolis but represents biofuel producers located throughout Minnesota. From Benson to Claremont, from Preston to Janesville, from Lamberton to Little Falls. When it comes to energy in Minnesota, all the power used in homes, businesses, and the transportation sector is imported, but for renewables. Yes, Minnesota is blessed with a well-educated populace, and Minnesota is blessed with abundant renewable resources, including biomass, which is used to make biofuels such as ethanol. But the ethanol industry is about more than the 1.2 billion gallons of clean biofuel produced in 2017. And the industry is about more than the $2.2 billion of GDP the industry added to the economy. It's also about environmental benefits and the 18,815 jobs that are supported by the industry. The biofuel industry in Minnesota is diverse, with annual production plant capacities ranging from 16 million gallons to 136 million gallons. These producers, regardless of size, are continually modernizing their operations. Whether it's the enzymes and yeast that are used in the fermentation, or hammer mills and variable frequency drive motors used in production. As Representative Miller noted, one of the most important pieces of advanced technology next is the combined heat and power and expander generator systems. And hopefully in your information packets, you have some photos of what these units are. These systems, the industry must capture and use, And these systems will help producers lower their carbon footprints even more, and it will help them be even more competitive in a global marketplace. In our estimation, combined heat and power and expander generator tax credit bill provides the appropriate level of credits so ethanol producers can make this next leap in energy system technology. And based on an ABF economic analysis, which was completed to assess the benefits of this bill, when fully utilized, it's understood that this could add another $2.4 million of GDP to the economy, boost household incomes by an additional $147 million, support an additional 1,458 jobs, and add an additional $17 million to state and local revenue. So in closing, this combined heat and power and expander generator tax credit bill holds great potential to unleash a host of environmental, economic, and employment benefits for rural communities as well as all of Minnesota. And we ask for your support of this bill and inclusion in the omnibus bill as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Questions for Mr. Rudnicki? Okay, to the next testifier. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Hello, my name is Brian Martinson. I'm the Director of State Government Affairs for Southern Minnesota Beet Sugar Cooperative. Thank you for hearing House File 1495 today, and thank you to Senator Miller for carrying this legislation.
I've been demoted, Chair.
That was nasty.
Representative Miller.
That, you are out of order. That's going to leave a mark.
All in favor?
Please continue.
Southern Minnesota Beet Sugar Cooperative is owned by over 500 farmer shareholders who grow beets over across 17 counties in southwestern and west central Minnesota. Our cooperative is plant is located in Renville, Minnesota, where this year we expect to process more than 3.6 million tons of beets and produce more than 500,000 tons of sugar. Our cooperative is the largest employer in the county of Renville with more than almost 400 full-time employees and a payroll that exceeds $25 million. Over the last 30 years, our industry has been challenged by largely unchanged sugar prices that have resulted in the closure of more than 50 sugar facilities across the U.S. Businesses like ours have remained successful by becoming more efficient and implementing changes to be a preferred source for our customers. Our cooperative has explored combined heat and power project as a means of continued improvement. Through feasibility and engineering studies, we believe that a CHP system will improve the efficiency of our factory, help control costs, strengthen the reliability of our operation, and make us a more environmentally sound and sustainable building business, and thus more attractive source of product for our customers. So what is keeping us from moving forward? Cost. This would be a difficult endeavor at any time, but with the added pressure of low commodity prices, especially for an ag cooperative where more than 90% of the revenue is returned to shareholders and yet still does not always mean break-even numbers back on the farm, you can understand the challenges of putting together a sizable investment back into the factory. Minnesota has historically been a good partner and took advantage of opportunities to support growth and stability for Minnesota industries. This legislation would help us and others bridge the gap to make sizable private investments that will grow and sustain these businesses. Thank you for your consideration. We appreciate your support.
Thank you, Mr. Martinson. Questions for Mr. Martinson? And we love the sugar beet growers. Thank you. The department? Oh, I'm sorry, Risa Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just wanted to make you aware of another resource. If you haven't checked already, the St. Paul Port Authority does have some millions of dollars that we gave them access to bond for a few years back for projects like this where we're capturing some of the heat and using it for what they perceived as renewable projects. And so I'd encourage you to look at that source of funding and see if you might qualify as well for some of those resources.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Radicki or Martinson? Okay, let's go to the department then. Thank you, gentlemen. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Representative Miller, and members for the record. My name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
And a very good one, I might add.
Thank you. This bill provides a non-refundable income tax credit with a 10-year carryover equal to 25% of the total cost of installing an eligible combined heat and power system and eligible expander generation program. Since the state would subsidize it at such a high rate, 25%, and the credit does not relate to taxable income, it seems that this could be money directly appropriated and prioritized among other spending programs through matching grade state grant programs. Grant programs or subsidy programs or directly appropriated dollars also provide designs that can be modeled to best achieve public outcomes that can be regularly reviewed. Review of the performance of how well tax expenditures achieve public outcomes does not often happen, although I know you do an excellent job, Mr. Chair. Additionally, a federal credit already exists for this type of program. The proposed state credit would provide a rate 5 times greater than the federal credit. We look forward to working with the committee and staff to discuss other drafting ideas that clarify the bill. If this bill moves through the process, the Department of Revenue looks forward to working with the Chair, Representative Miller, and staff. Thank you for the opportunity to be a resource. And I think that 5 times greater than the federal credit may have talked about when it was a 50% credit. And I think that rate has been now moved down to 25. So
thank you, Mr. Cummings. Questions for Mr. Cummings? Any other questions for members? Representative Miller, you want to wrap it up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your time and I ask for your support.
Thank you very much. I will renew my motion to House File 1495 as the matter be laid out for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Representative Hertas. Yeah. Representative Hertas moves House File 4415, and I believe there is an amendment.
The A2 amendment, Mr. Chair.
We're not going to do the A1?
No.
Okay, so let's wait. I want members to be able to have the amendment for a time here. So, Representative Hertas, if you could please describe the bill as it most likely will be amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, just before the spring break, I was contacted by a colleague who does tax preparation out in western Minnesota along the Fargo-Moorhead border area. And he contacted me about the stillborn tax credit, which was passed into law last year. The tax credit provides a $2,000 tax credit to families who should have the misfortune of losing a child during pregnancy. What we found out is that his Minnesota resident client gave birth across state lines to a stillborn child, and there is no other health care provider out in the Fargo-Moorhead area. And under the manner in which the statute was drafted, under I believe it's section 144.121, has a very specific definition of a certificate that has to be recorded with the Department of Revenue. So having heard of the story, it didn't seem sensible that we should deny some Minnesota residents based on where that stillborn birth occurred. So I said I would look into the matter. I contacted the Department of Revenue. I wanted to find out if it was just clearly intended to be written that way, whether it was an interpretation of statute. And Mr. Paul Cummins was most helpful in knowing about this issue. And in fact, he actually stunned me because within 30 nanoseconds, he right away started quoting a statute and was familiar with the issue already when I had contacted him about it. Mr. Cummins did explain to me that there were some technicalities with regard to the certificate that's required in order to get this stillborn tax credit. So with that, I contacted Representative Marquardt and Representative Lean, who also represent that area, and they were fully supportive of doing this. So it's a bipartisan technical fix to basically allow some of the problems that were discovered as enacted, and with the help of Mr. Michael and with Mr. Cummins, we've made technical corrections that will resolve this problem. And just for a little bit of other information, there are about 5 to 6 stillborn births per 1,000 live births, so that's about 0.5%. And the frequency in which these would happen across state lines is probably even smaller than that, but the department was grateful that we could once and for all just clean this up and get it fixed. And with that, I'll let Mr. Michael describe the A2 amendment.
So Representative Hertaus moves the H-4415A2 amendment. And Mr. Michael, if you could please describe what the amendment's doing.
Mr. Chairman, in addition to the printed language, we need to add an oral change to the amendment as well. And that would read page 2, line 2, delete birth and insert stillbirth, which then will tie it to the definition of stillbirth below, which is linked to the Minnesota statutory definition of stillbirth. I think it's probably better to explain what the bill does than to explain the amendment, because once the amendment's adopted, or maybe you want to just vote on the amendment as an
so
author.
So few members will get, since it's an author, we'll get it on the bill and then we can discuss it further. So let's first of all take the oral amendment. Could you once again, Representative Hertaus moves the oral amendment. Okay, Representative Hertaus incorporates the oral amendment into the A2 amendment. So we now have the H-4415A2 amendment before us as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Now, Mr. Michael, could you tell us what we just did?
Mr. Chairman, essentially, to describe what the bill and the amendment does is two things. As Representative Hertaus indicated, the current stillbirth credit only applies to instances in which there is a Minnesota certificate of birth resulting in a stillbirth that's issued in order to qualify. That has the effect of essentially preventing Minnesota residents who actually have their stillbirth occur in another state or country, for that matter, if it were to happen in Canada, for example, from getting this credit. So the substantive change that Representative Hertaus's bill makes is to allow the credit to residents who experience the stillbirth in another state. The technical change that the department has been concerned about is the way the credit is written now. The credit is allowed to the individual that would be able to claim the stillborn child as a tax dependent. That's sort of a metaphysical question in a way, because there's a support test that would apply, and there are all sorts of very complicated tax rules that determine who's a tax dependent. So, for example, if the parents of the stillborn child are not married and are not filing a joint return, therefore it would be unclear to revenue which of those parents should get the credit. Other instances, the mother may be a tax dependent of someone else, and in that case, the stillborn child could not have been a tax dependent of the mother, and revenue doesn't know to whom they should issue the certificate in that case. So what the what the bill and the amendment does is to change it instead to being determined by who's on the birth certificate, who's listed on the birth certificate, rather than this tax dependency test, and to clarify that it's only allowed to residents with one exception. There are instances where the spouse of a resident member of the military under federal law can still be a resident of Minnesota, but for tax purposes is not a resident. It's a way that they insulate those spouses of military people from being subject to Minnesota income tax. Those people could be living in Minnesota and experience a stillbirth. The changes in Representative Hertas' bill allows the credit to them. The amendment essentially addresses situations where there is a surrogacy order that's in place, and it preserves the existing treatment that allows the credit in that case to go to the individual that obtained the surrogacy order before the stillbirth occurred. So I think I've tried to describe as best as possible the changes that are being made in this bill. And most of these changes, in a slightly different version, passed the House in the 2017 omnibus tax bill. This provision was enacted in the state government finance or the supplemental bill in 2016, and it was not really did not have time to be vetted technically by the folks at Revenue, and that's why partially some of these issues have occurred.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. First of all, before we go to the department, anyone in the audience wish to testify on behalf of this bill or with concerns? Okay, to the department, then we'll go to member questions. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the tax policy manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Welcome to the committee.
As Mr. Michael mentioned, this was passed in the 2016 appropriations bill, and, you know, Mr. Chair, I guess maybe there would be less, you know, updating to do if this was passed in the tax bill, you know. So maybe pretty much we'll work on this. I did want to thank Representative Hertas for bringing this bill forward. These are circumstances in people's lives in which are particularly devastating. And then on top of that, if you're a resident who lives in Moorhead and travels to Fargo or lives in, a person in Southwest Minnesota going to Sioux Falls, and then they find out that that another person who drives to Marshall or who goes to Detroit Lakes would be able to have this credit, but under the law they couldn't. This is something that is pointed out that really does help correct that. The reason why I'm putting this on talking today is first to thank Representative Hertas, but also to say that there are lots of technical things that this does. There are directives within the bill that the Department of Revenue has to do specific things. And these are also places and times in people's lives that are very difficult. So I just want to ensure that we can continue to work with you and Representative Hertas as the Department of Revenue and the Department of Health continues to ensure that we have the right sequencing, we have the right words, we have the right directives so that at the end of session we have something that works. But I really believe that the bill plus the amendment is really moving in a direction that can be helpful here. But we do have experts with the Department of Health here if it's helpful to sort of continue to dig in how the names are placed. But I think we're moving in this direction. I think this bill works. We're going to continue to look at it, and if there's some things that can continue to clarify, we'll provide feedback to the department and committee and Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Questions from members for the department? I think we understand what we're doing here on this one. Any other questions for Representative Hertas? Okay, Representative Hertas, if you could wrap it up, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I thought this was going to be real simple to fix, and I found out there were more complications I was unaware of, but I've just want to thank Mr. Cummins and all the other folks that have contacted me about this. I think we're have kind of gone a light year ahead in terms of just cleaning up some of the problems that were created in the first draft of the bill. So thank you.
Thank you, sir. And so I've heard House renews his motion of 4415 as amended to be later for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative Hertas, for your work on that bill and others. I will move House File 4370. And there is an amendment, the A1 amendment. That's an author's amendment. To get the bill in the shape the author would like, I will move the H4370A1 amendment. All fair say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have the bill as amended. Ms. Dalton, what are we doing here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what this bill does is 15 months after the state starts collecting sales tax from remote sales, either because Quill is overturned or because there's a federal law passed, there will be an adjustment to the sales tax rates to make it revenue neutral.
Okay, that's what the bill does as amended. Is there anyone that would testify on behalf of the bill with concerns? Would the department like to be a resource? You could be a supporter, too. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Welcome to the committee.
And Mr. Chair, you've had some fine pieces of legislation this week.
Like yesterday.
Yes, absolutely. So I don't want to start raining on anyone's parade.
But...
Mr. Chair, according to the bill, beginning 15 months after the state begins collecting sales tax on marketplace providers and or other remote sellers, the Commissioner of Revenue is instructed to reduce the general sales tax and the legacy sales tax rates down by a revenue-neutral amount to reflect increased sales tax collections from these remote sales. Mr. Chair, the bill seems to try to address what the Supreme Court may decide on the Wayfair decision. The Wayfair versus South Dakota case was heard yesterday in the Supreme Court, and anyone listening to the proceeding would agree that the outcome of the case is not clear. We seem to have Gorsuch and Kennedy saying that that we should overturn Quill, and we're hearing from Breyer and others that maybe we should continue with longstanding precedent. So anyone listening to the proceeding would agree that the outcome of the case is not clear. The justices had a lively discussion, with some justices arguing that Quill should be overturned and others believing this question is up to Congress. So we have no idea what the Supreme Court will decide and if that decision will cleanly overturn Quill, uphold Quill, or and leave it to Congress, or some create some path in between. So developing legislation to anticipate what the Supreme Court might do creates a high level of fiscal uncertainty into the future. We have heard that this approach would lower the rate once the base is broadened, which applies to legacy funds as well. But there is no broadening of the base in this case. Our current statutes impose tax on items being sold remotely into Minnesota, except for the federal limitation at issue in Wayfair. This bill may encourage some taxpayers who are currently out of compliance with existing laws to stay out of compliance until the due date in the bill. They may rely on the date in the bill, which could interfere with our goal of ensuring that taxpayers are receiving the right amount, paying the right amount under the law, and then they would be artificially inflating the amount of the rate adjustment. This bill could also bind future legislatures to a position that is not known, and that could lead to financial instability. What we can tell you is that we are closely monitoring the Wayfair versus South Dakota case at the Supreme Court. Once a decision is made public, we will provide information to Minnesota taxpayers about how that decision will be administered. If this bill moves through the process, the Department of Revenue looks forward to working with you, Mr. Chair, other members, and staff, and we thank you for the opportunity to be a resource today.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings, and your points are very well taken, and this is a work in progress here in the process. Ms. Dalton, let's say we have a clean overturn of Quill. How much money is the state likely to receive? Or maybe that's a Templin or a Schill question. Or Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, I would actually defer to Ms. Templin, but I know that the number has varied dramatically over the time. I think probably the highest number I've heard is 200 million under the current system, just because of some other things that have happened in the past. But I'm not sure if we've got anything more definitive.
Maybe Ms. Templin could try. Please state your name and who represents for the record, please. And your point's well taken, Mr. Cummings. If it's a clean break, it's one thing. If it's this way, except on Tuesday, then where are we? Ms. Templin.
Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal. Mr. Chair, I believe the information you're looking for is in the revenue estimate on page 2. It says that right now that the estimated sales tax growth rate is 4.4%, which would raise about $150 million. And the rate would have to be reduced roughly by 0.10% to up to 0.15%.
Big questions for Ms. Templin.
Mr.
Cummings.
I know this is something that the department has regularly looked at. I think there's a federal study that is out related to this too. But this number changes quite a bit and has changed, and partly because over time, many of the largest retailers are coming into compliance, and so we see more and more people coming into compliance with our tax laws. And so the number has been in continuous decline over time. There was a time earlier in this decade or in the late aughts in which we were seeing, multiple hundreds of millions of dollars, and now we're seeing that number decline over time. So,
okay. So I believe we have a law on the books that says that what do we do with the Quill case if what happens? Help me out here, Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there's actually two provisions in law that could be affected by a Quill decision. The first one is the Marketplace Provider Act provisions that were passed last year, which have an effective date of July 1, 2019, or when Quill is overturned, right, if that occurs earlier. But the second thing is a very longstanding provision in our law related to economic nexus, which, of course, was overturned in Quill. That language was never taken out of our statute, but instead there is language that says, to the extent allowed under federal law, you have a duty to collect if you have an economic presence here in this state.
Okay. So even, Ms. Dalton, even with the law that we wrote last year, you could get in the same situation where if it's not a clean repeal of Quill, we could find ourselves debating some of these same issues that Mr. Cummings just talked about in this bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. Although there is a definite date that the marketplace provider provisions do go into effect, no later than July 1, 2019.
Okay. Yes, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And the discussion's been about the Supreme Court arguments because those are in the press right now and they're timely. But the bill, as you've got it drafted, also says that change would happen 60 days after a federal law is enacted that affects these things. And I got to say, that's even more difficult, I think, to predict given the current climate than what the Supreme Court might do with those individuals. And I'm just not sure if it's a good precedent for us to delegate decision-making authority about our tax policy to people in Washington, no matter what their title is, instead of reacting once they finally decided on something. Because, as you said, they could come up with something that says, you know, on weekends it's a different rate than it's during the week or whatever. Or if you need something, you need to order something at 2:00 in the morning when your local store is closed, it's a different circumstance than when they're open. I mean, I don't think they would go that way, but I mean, I just think we shouldn't delegate decision making about what our tax policy is to, but instead do what we've always done, which is thoughtfully review what they've done, and oftentimes we comply, and sometimes we choose not to.
Nurse Avlathar, I totally agree with you on waiting for Congress to act could be, well, we'll just leave that alone. Representative Avlathar, you still have the floor.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. That's why I just have some real hesitancy. I mean, we've talked about, you know, the dangers of inflators, and people's talking about these are sort of autopilot tax increases. Well, this is sort of an autopilot tax decrease decided on any basis that we don't even have an understanding of what it is. And so I just really kind of like to go slow and react a little bit more than lead.
Well, Representative Avlathar, I do not like inflators unless it's an inflator to lower a tax. Then it's okay.
That's fine.
Chair Markhorst.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Just a clarification. So if there's a complete overturn of the Quill case, and with the previous law you said that's on the books, Ms. Dalton, does that mean that automatically it would require remote sellers to collect sales tax, or would it still take an affirmative separate act of the legislature to do that?
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it would not take any further action on the part of the legislature, because we do have this language that's in our law, which says, to the extent allowed by federal law, these remote sellers have a duty to collect. One of the issues is just, when will that duty to collect actually occur? There is a kind of an implication here that it will occur 60 days after the start of a calendar quarter, 60 days after the law goes into effect or Quill is overturned. That just has to do with some timing that is probably likely for when the state would actually get around to implementing it, particularly given some of our agreements under Streamline that require certain types of notices related to it. That language might need to be further massaged, but that's just to kind of give you an indication of when would this likely happen.
And Chair Markhorst, the reason I put that date out further was to see what happens with Quill. And not wait, and if you wait around for Congress, now that's not the reason. The reason was to see what happens with Quill. And then if not, then as a state, we're going to start,
Thank you,
Mark.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Ms. Dalton. That's very interesting. So there wouldn't be any further action. So it looks like if there was this complete overturn of Quill, there'd be maybe $150 million out there to either use for spending or tax cuts. And I guess what Representative Loeffler is saying, I'd kind of leave it in our discretion rather than just an automatic, because, you look at these brick-and-mortar businesses who have suffered in competitiveness because of this, and you may want to do something special for those folks too. So I do worry about kind of binding a future legislator would be my concern. So thank you, Mr.
Chair. Thank you, Chair Mark. Other questions for members? Mr. Cummings? Well, he gives us the thumbs up, so let's go. I'll move on. I'll renew my motion to House File 4370 as amended to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. With realization, members, we got some work to do on that one with the department. So, item last, let's go to the House File 3711. And just, members, so we know what we're doing here, we had a hearing at 8:15 this morning in Chair Drazkowski's committee on 3710, which is basically a clone of this, just for timing issues here, so that it could make all of the appropriate committees. And with that being said, I think what I'll do is bring the gentleman from Essentia up here, if we could. And we have an amendment that I would like to... 2 minutes? Oh, yeah, okay, please pass those out. We won't act on them until everybody has them. But we have mine. Okay, let's go. I will move the H371182 amendment. And what this amendment does is it basically nails down who's on the board. And if you look at page 1.10, the mayor would have a designee, the city council, the county board, the three representatives from the medical business entity West,
one representative from the medical business into the east. And the amendment, I thought yesterday, I thought, you know what, and I hadn't even talked to anybody about this, and of course this is all up for negotiations as we move throughout the remainder of the session, is to get the governor to have an appointment on that board, since there would be state money involved here. And then I think, Representative Metz, I think we got the steel language right. Did you, if you could take a look at that on the A2 amendment, we want to make sure that's done right. That gets a little tricky. In fact, I couldn't figure out why the Canadian consulate wanted to meet with me. So the Canadians came down, and we had a nice discussion. And then you can look at the second page there, some parking revenue. We recapture that to reduce some of the state's costs. So, and, members, this is not by any means a final anything, because we've got some work to do on this, but I just wanted to have the tax committee look at this, and we do have folks that have driven from away, so I should let them make a few comments here. So I'll move the H371182 amendment. Any further discussion? Representative Loeffler?
Mr. Chair, can you explain, maybe it's because we're not supposed to name anything, but we have Medical Business Entity East and Medical Business Entity West, and one has one hospital, one has two hospitals. What we and yet you've presented this in terms of Essentia. Does Essentia own all three and operate all three of these hospitals or not? Or can you give us a little more background? I've just never seen this kind of entity east, entity west.
Yeah, we don't like putting the names in there because they could be bought out by Amway or something, and now they changed their name. Please state your name and who you are for the record. Please turn to the Loeffler question.
Yes. My name is Michael Mahoney. I'm the Vice President of Public Policy for Essentia Health.
Welcome to the committee. Representative Loeffler's
question. Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Representative Loeffler. Within the medical district as it's laid out, there are actually two health systems, three hospitals and two health systems. Two hospitals are under the umbrella of Essentia. St. Luke's Hospital is St. Luke's Hospital System. And so there is one located on the east end of the medical district and one on the west, and thereby the definition of east and west entity.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you. And then there is a hospital operated outside of Essentia, did you say that?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Of the three hospitals within the district, two are Essentia facilities, one is not.
Okay.
Representative Loeffler.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And all three would be included, though, within this medical district and an advantage through this bill?
Mr. Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. All three are located within the medical district and would benefit basically from Essentia's investment.
Representative Loeffler.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It didn't come through. I'm still trying to figure out how this fits with our hospital certificates of need and all those other sorts of things. And now it's getting a little more murky to me exactly, but I'm trying to still understand the project. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I would like to thank my co-authors on this bill. I'd like to thank Representative Mary Murphy. And you'll see that we have David Metz here, and then Representative Schultz has been working on this, and Representative Olson. Who did I forget? I forget somebody? Okay. So with that, let's see what this next amendment is here. Let's see. Who would like to move this amendment?
It's my amendment. Mr. Chair, great. You know what? I think because my amendment was drafted off the original bill, I'm going to need to make an oral amendment to your amendment.
Certainly.
And that would just change line 1.14 on your amendment 8.2 from three representatives to two representatives, and then I think it would reflect my amendment.
Oh, so you're bored. Okay.
And Mr. Chair, that would reflect their investment amounts, so they're proportional to representation on the board. And I think St. Luke's Hospital is here. If you want them to testify, they would like to testify.
Sure. Let's bring to this amendment, let's bring St. Luke's down. While they're coming out, let's get the oral amendment. Mr. Michael, how would you word that? Or Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the oral amendment would be Representative Schultz moves to amend the H. 3711A2 amendment as follows. page.
Just wait, time out. What amendment?
Your amendment.
Oh, yeah, let's get that then line this up here.
Move to amend that amendment as follows. Page 1, line 14, delete 3 and insert 2.
Oh, that's easy. Okay, so what we have is basically an oral amendment on the H371182 amendment to, on page 1.14, under 4 there, delete 3 and insert 2 to get the amendment this way the author would like it. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevailed. Now we have the Schultz amendment. You just amended it, Dawn.
No, you just amended your amendment with her amendment.
Yes.
Oh. I will make a motion to reconsider. Okay, let's slow down here a little bit. How do I get that off of there?
Too late.
Ms. Dalton?
Conference. You have to reconsider. Okay.
I move to reconsider the vote that was just taken on H371182, and I would respectfully speak against that amendment and would like my motion to reconsider approved. Chair Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just a request. Could we hear testimony before we vote on the reconsideration?
Certainly. Yes.
I think this is an important issue relative to the makeup of the board, and I perceive the amendment that was just offered, and I'm from the cities and not from Duluth, but it seems to me that the amendment creates a level playing field within the healthcare system in Duluth, but I think it would be important to hear the testimony
That's a good idea. Representative Schultz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I represent this district, and I'm trying to keep peace along the lake, and I think I would encourage committee members to support my oral amendment.
Okay. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
My name is John Strange. I'm the CEO of St. Luke's.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Okay.
To the amendment.
To the amendment. St. Luke's is looking for fairness. We're very supportive of the idea of working on the infrastructure. We sit three blocks away from the Essentia campus, and we have 2,500 employees in Duluth, almost 3,000 in the entire system. We're a three-hospital system with clinics throughout the region, especially up in the range and northeastern Minnesota. We serve patients from International Falls down to Hinckley, over through Grand Rapids to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And we are a comprehensive system, and we struggle with the same infrastructure issues that Essentia does. And we're looking forward to the ability to work with the city on those infrastructure issues to improve the medical campus, which is a huge economic driver in our region. And so what we're looking for is an equal say in the commission so that we can have the same ability as Essentia to help guide the city and the governor in what happens with health care in Duluth.
Okay, thank you. And I don't think you should have any seats on the board. I think it should be at zero. I went to one just because I'm a nice guy. Why should you have a seat on the board? As far as how much money are you putting into the project?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We are currently looking at about $340 million. We've taken a little different approach than Essentia in that we've been building and changing our structure over the course of the last 20 years to meet healthcare technology. And we've built two office buildings on campus and Building A, which is a start. It's a half the base for what's going to be eventually an eight-story patient tower. It's a different approach. We're doing it section by section, trying to match what's happening with technology and healthcare and not getting our facility ahead of the technology changes. We've put $121 million into buildings on campus at this point in time. We've also spent $59 million on clinics throughout the region. But our program and plan is a little bit more on a step basis. We're not going to replace the whole institution at once. We're going to take it off in sections. Building A was completed to support the tower, but it was also completed to expand our surgery because of the volumes and the changes in technology. Nick, we're hoping to start in September with expanding our ER, which is seriously undersized. We're a 14-bed ER. At our peak, we need 35 beds. And so our ER volumes continue to grow. We continue to serve the region. So we need to match our facilities to do that. We've started a comprehensive campus plan in 2003, and we've been working down that road over that period of time.
Okay. Thank you very much, sir. You know, what you've done in the past is wonderful. We love St. Luke's. You're a great institution. But I'm looking at the – and this bill looks to the future. So I'm not – whatever you did in the past is wonderful, and we thank you for that. What are you planning to do with – you're not going to have two seats on the board. Okay, we don't – that's a given. That's not going to happen. Okay, I'm a nice guy, so, you know, we'll go to – no, you're putting down – you're going 2-1. Okay, so no, essentially should be a 3. You should be at 0, but I conceded to 1. So with that being said, what do you have in writing on the books that you're going to do in that zone, in that district?
Currently, we're looking at $26 million starting this year. We're planning within the next 5 to 7 years to work on the tower, the second part of the base, and then start to plan for the tower. So we're probably looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of $342 million when it's all completed over the next 10 years, probably taking in steps. So in the next, in this decade, we're probably going to be in the neighborhood of $100, $120 million. And then continuing out next decade into up to the $340 million. And that's current day price. I'm sure by the time we get out there, it's going to be more.
Sure.
But, and that's without financing costs. That's just straight construction.
Thank you. Mr. Mahoney and members, we do have to leave at 1:45. So this, we will be talking more about this at a later time. But I would like to get the bill back to the way it was before we leave it. Mr. Mahoney?
Mr. Chair, thank you. So to the comment regarding equal and fair representation, Essentia is the one that's coming to the table right now with an $800 million plan. We've put 18 months into the plan. We're hoping to break ground March of 2019, a year from now, quite frankly. These are real dollars. We have already received responses for financing. This is not something that's 5 to 7 years out. And quite frankly, when you look at the $800 million compared to a $200 million that St. Luke's has proposed, once you reduce the amount of public infrastructure they're seeking, it is a 3-to-1 makeup and composition. And so there's a fair and equitable representation of the board composition. And quite frankly, from a financing perspective, we have concerns over making an $800 million investment in the city without being able to have a significant say and what happens around us.
So we've got $800 million plus for sure.
That's correct.
With $120 million maybe.
Correct.
Okay. So with that, I will move to reconsider the last vote on H3711A2. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. We now have my amendment. Do we now have the Schultz amendment to reconsider? Any discussion on the Schultz amendment? I would ask that we oppose the oral amendment from Representative Schultz. Discussion, Representative Schultz, and then Loeffler.
I would encourage you to vote in support of my amendment. We need two healthy hospital healthcare systems in Duluth to keep our prices competitive and low. Right now, behind the Mayo region, we are the second highest cost healthcare area in the state of Minnesota. So we need healthy competition. And so I think the proportion of future investments would be a 2-to-1 ratio rather than a 3-to-1 ratio. I appreciate Chair David's adding one seat, but I would encourage my amendment to go from 3-to-1 to 2-to-1 representation.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is the Tax Committee, not the Health Committee, but I'm concerned about we have seen in the marketplace in Minnesota that whether or not you're competitive or not and whether you have competitors that are healthy makes a huge difference in premium costs. And we've seen that in the regional differences in premiums, and this is the private market setting it. The cheapest health insurance is in the metro area because we have multiple healthy competitive health systems and hospitals. And it's not in the best interest of our residents or the state to advantage one particular health system over another in an area that has some healthy choices for the people who are there. I hear a lot about the private sector and we ought to allow, you know, competition. And I'm not comfortable stepping in with tax resources that are going to potentially disadvantage, you know, long-established healthcare relationships and make potentially a market less competitive. And, you know, these proposals I don't think have even gone through the typical hospital review process that we have for certificates of need that Regions is doing to add hospital beds now, that we have traditionally had in Minnesota to keep healthcare costs low by preventing overbuilding. That isn't even addressed in this bill. And so I do think we do have an obligations to the people who are going to be served, whether this was happening in my area of the state, your area of the state, or it happens in Duluth, to really look at what the long-term implications are for our health system and its competitiveness and the prices. Because we just last year authorized as a legislature a proposal to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to try and bring down health insurance premiums. And part of that is totally related to how many health systems and health providers there are in a geographic area. That probably has much more impact than the money that we've put in.
Mr. Mahoney?
Mr. Chair, perhaps a point of clarification would be helpful here. When we build a new hospital, St. Mary's Medical Center is currently 380 beds. We're not seeking any additional bed capacity. What we're doing is building a new state-of-the-art facility that will be available for all the patients that come to us from across northern Minnesota. The plans call for private rooms, and so this is not a bed moratorium issue. We plan to stay within our current licensure.
Chair Groffel? Or excuse me, Representative Blocker.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand that there's may not be a need for new, there may not be new beds, but overbuilding can also increase costs depending upon whether, and so we've typically had some of those kind of reviews. But my more important question is just, it was not about what they're proposing. It's about keeping a healthy marketplace for both systems. And the amendment that's before us is about making sure that both systems are at the table in planning for a regional redevelopment. It's not about the hospital proposals per se. It's about public infrastructure that would be financed by the state in partnership with the city. And so it's, I think, I'm just making the point that I think it's in the public interest that that infrastructure serve both campuses and that therefore both campuses be proportionately represented in the decision making.
And to that point, if we wanted to go proportional, as you say, St. Luke's would have zero because they have nothing in writing on the table. Ascension's over $800 million, so that would be zero. With that, I'm going to go to Representative Groffel, Lesh, and then we're going to vote on the amendment. Representative Groffel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I know that we have gone far afield of what the Schultz Amendment is to the Davids Amendment, but just a reminder for members that as the project has been explained to me, there is no dispute about whether there's going to be this consolidation of a campus. The question is where it's going to be. And so the increment and, you know, incentive to keep it in Duluth is to leverage existing infrastructure so we don't put a big blast crater in the middle of Duluth with a new campus up on top of the hill, possibly up in Hermantown. So this idea that somehow we're picking winners and losers here, we're not. What we're doing is we're making a strategic investment so we can keep Duluth whole, so we can actually keep and reinvigorate and keep developing their downtown area. Otherwise, we're going to have that if you just leave it unabated, what's going to happen is this campus is going to go up. It's going to leave Duluth. It's going to go up on a greenfield site where it's going to be cheaper, where the land's going to be cheaper, and it's going to end up causing massive redevelopment costs for the city of Duluth and the region. That's why. So we're kind of going far afield of the amendment here, but this is not some sort of picking business A over business B or some sort of massive public subsidy project. It's a good public policy to make sure that we leverage existing infrastructure, existing public investments for road, water, sewer, and not building up new stuff. So, as usual, the chairman has decided to author an excellent bill. However you guys want to do this board thing, I would just encourage the stakeholders to figure it out so that we're not doing anything other than doing what the chair wants. Thanks.
I agree with the chair, Groffel. Chair Lesh, and then we're going to vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my, my question is for the chair. You know, during my tenure here, we've gotten our fingernails dirty with multiple hospital situations. The Maple Grove one, I know. Representative Zellers was heavily involved in it because it was in his district. With Mayo, the NC, Representative Norton was heavily involved in because it was in her district. Now, each of those projects have implications that spread far beyond the district, but I guess I do have some concern. I understand you're authoring this bill, and I did ask Mr. Mahoney when he came in, and I've asked Representative Schultz a little bit about it too, but why her interests don't seem to be really represented in this, and I have some concerns about that. And I was wondering if you could tell me what's behind why you're authoring the bill, and I understand that you want a certain member on the board, and I guarantee you've talked to these folks about this more than I have, Mr. Chair, so I assume you understand it better than I do, but I'm concerned that Representative Schultz doesn't have as much of a say in this as we have in past projects, and I'm wondering if that's going to spell some issues on the back end, because the past hospital politics that we've done have always heavily involved the member.
Okay, the reason that I'm carrying this bill is because I wanted to carry DMC really, really bad, but in 2012 we lost the majority, and I said, you better find a DFL member to carry this thing, and that's how we, Representative Norton, picked it up. I was working with the mothership in Rochester to carry the DMC bill, and I liked the way that Mayo had presented better than what we ended up with. And so when I saw this issue coming forth, I was very interested in carrying it because I think I can do some good things for Duluth on this bill. But that being said, I'm going to get in big trouble with the Speaker if we don't get over there. So to the vote, I would prefer a no vote at this time. And my amendment will probably, not for today, will probably go to zero because members, Ascension is looking over $800 million in writing. St. Luke's is zero in writing. Yeah, they have some maybe we mights, but so if we want to go proportionally, they should be at zero, but the nice guy that I am, peace in the valley type of guy, I'm willing to go to one. But so with that, I would encourage a no vote to the Schultz Amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say no. No. Motion does not prevail. So with that, we're not going to lay this over. What we're going to do is I am going to table House File 3711 as amended so we can bring it up off the table. It's not ready to go to be laid over for possible inclusion. With that, thank you very much for your work today, members. Good government all the time.